Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal. I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're going to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hey, good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing great, man. Really, really well.
I'm glad to hear it.
So, a cool article in the New Jersey, the dining section of the Star Ledger on January 10th that just totally hit home for me.
This is the article by TJ Fodoraro.
Mm-hmm.
TJ is the, here's a little full disclosure. TJ Fodoraro is a friend of ours, a good friend of ours, and he is a big high muckety muck at the Ledger, but he also writes the wine column occasionally called The Nose. And he's actually a great wine writer, he really is. And he was the manager of the first fine dining restaurant, and that when he hired me, he gave me my first bartending job. Isn't that cool?
That is cool.
Well, so what does he have to say this week?
So anyway, TJ writes about kind of the old wine. One of the readers asked a question about the old Gallo wine called Barbarone that kind of has all but disappeared from the shelves. And so it brought back a lot of memories for me.
Barbarone. I got to tell you, Mark. I'm a wine expert. I never heard of Barbarone.
Yeah, that's because it's a made-up name.
It's like, you know, it sort of sounds like it should be Italian, but I'm all around Italy. I never saw any Barbarone.
Yeah, well, there's plenty in Brooklyn.
Not in the boot, lots, not in the heel.
Lots of Barbarone in Brooklyn. I'm pretty sure it's actually grown in Brooklyn, I think, Barbarone.
What's Barbarone?
So anyway, the memory that this brought back is Barbarone was, if you've ever bought the big jug wines of Gallo or Peachy or the 1 gallon things with a little kind of knot hole for your
thumbs. I never have.
This twist off top.
Nope, never did.
Well, they were that. I mean, this is the first wine I ever drank in my life. This is
I
the wine
see
that
you
I drank.
Drink so much beer.
This is the wine I drank at my grandparents' table.
Oh,
where, you know, you're 6 or 7 years old and you first get to try wine. Well, Grandpa used to keep by the foot of his chair,
mm-hmm.
and he doled it out as you were allowed to have.
A lot of my Italian friends I go over their house and have dinner, and it would be the same thing.
But honestly, until TJ wrote this article, I didn't even know it was Barbarone. All I knew was this kind of secret code that Grandpa would talk in, and you know, TJ wrote a little bit about the Gallo, but
your grandfather wasn't in the mob, was he?
I cannot say. No,
he's just trying to add to the mystique of Captain Lombardi Restaurant.
My grandfather was a funeral director in Brooklyn at the time.
Yeah, that's close
all,
enough.
That's all I'm going to say. Anyway, so the Barbarone, he used to go. He didn't like the Gallo version of the Barbarone, and he liked the Opici version.
Uh-huh.
And I also think it was like 10 cents cheaper. But the Opici version was not available in Brooklyn at the time. So he had to drive to Jersey to get the Opici version of the Barbarone. And he'd drive to Jersey and then come back with like 20 cases of gallon jugs of Barbarone.
So you got to spread the cost of that drive over as many gallons
exactly.
as you possibly can.
You know, because he didn't want to have to drive to Jersey again.
I got
to
ask you a question.
Knows.
Did he use the hearse? Did he fill up the hearse?
No, my grandfather had a limousine.
But what the dead guy rode sitting up in the passenger seat?
No, you rent the hearse from the funeral parlor. He didn't own the funeral parlor. He rented space.
I got it. Okay.
But he had his own limousine,
I got
which
it.
We weren't allowed to touch the windows.
It's like
1971, and he's got electric windows, and everybody else on the planet has roll down windows, and he's my grandfather, so I think it's really cool, but I'm not allowed to touch them. So, of course, every once in a while, you just go...
Did it let you roll them down at all?
No, never.
So, I got to say, though, the image I have in my head of your grandfather, the Undertaker, with a hearse full of wine is something I'm going to hold on to, even though it wasn't true.
There's a little fact about this wine that I'm not sure even you know, Francis.
Yeah.
Up in Catherine Lombardi Restaurant right now, it is filled with pictures of my family.
Yeah.
And some great old pictures from the 40s and the 30s and the 20s and the 50s and just kind of cataloging... My grandparents.
I know, Mark. I own the other half of that restaurant.
Well, they don't
know.
Oh,
okay. All right.
They're
okay.
Listening to the show.
Okay.
So it catalogs a lot of this period of time. Well, on VJ Day, victory over Japan, apparently, so goes the
yeah,
story.
Yeah, no, we definitely
my,
won.
So goes the story from my family.
That was funny.
There was a, yes, very funny. Ha. So on VJ Day, there is a large picture of my family and the entire block for having a block party in celebration of VJ Day.
Uh-huh.
Now, of course, my family, who is actually over over there, as
fighting,
it were,
fighting
the war.
War,
aren't in the picture, but,
right.
but everybody else is in the picture. And everybody who lived on the block is in the picture. And there's a whole bunch of people who must be cousins because they look exactly like people
right.
in my family.
Right. Right.
But in the center of the picture, there is my grandfather is pouring a glass of wine for my godmother, and everybody's got the biggest smiles on their face, and there's about 40, 50 people in the picture.
No.
But if you look very closely, there's and they're pouring a gallon of Opici Barberone is
can
what they're pouring.
Can you see in the
oh,
picture?
Absolutely. You can see the gallon jug of the Opici Barberone.
That was worth that ever so long story. That was worth listening to you for
so
6 minutes.
So if you want to see you know, what the gallon jug of Opici Barberone that lived in that house throughout my childhood by my grandfather's chair, You can see it. There's a picture of it on the wall of your restaurant.
That's a charming story. I did not know that.
Yeah,
that's
I know.
Really great. Opici Barberone.
I'm filled with things that you do not know.
A small world, isn't it? Now, we're going to touch briefly on, I hate to talk about foie gras again, but we're not going to really talk about it in a serious way. We're just going to mention that, you know, in Chicago they passed the ban on foie gras. Well, everybody's ignoring the law, right? and it's great. It's turned out the foie gras production in Chicago, or foie gras consumption in California has gone up. Like, people who never tried it before, like, it's illegal? Ooh, can I try it?
Perhaps.
Oh, I got to get some. I'll pay anything.
You make a gin in your backyard. Can I have a glass?
So the thing about it is the mayor thinks it's the dumbest law that's ever been passed.
Yeah, and you
so,
know what? The mayor's right.
Yeah, well, and he's got to enforce the law. Chicago health inspectors paid a surprise visit to a previously warned River North restaurant last week to catch it in the act of selling foie gras, only to find that it wasn't selling it. It was giving it away. And so they didn't give the $250 ticket. Yeah.
I caught you duck-handed.
We turned around and came back, and the ordinance prohibits the sale of foie gras. It does not address giving it away. That would be up to the framers of the laws to close that loophole. And what they said is they were giving it away as a complimentary sidebar to another dish. Well, that's a little fishy, but I'm giving it away,
I think
but
it's, I don't
this.
Think it's fishy at all. I think it sounds just ducky.
Oh, very good. Very good. I like it.
Are you going to let me get a couple more puns in before the end of the segment?
I'll try to feed you as many straight lines as I can in the next minute and a half. The chef, Craig DeFazio, would only say, the law says you can't sell it. We're not selling it. And I'm with him. But the Alderman Joe Moore, who's the sponsor of the bill, says they're giving the product only to paying customers. If you're paying for a meal, you're paying for whatever food they serve. The law doesn't need to be changed. What we need is this city to enforce it. Mayor Daley called the law the silliest law Chicago aldermen have ever passed in the august history of that great American
yeah,
city.
I give a big raspberry to Alderman Moore.
Yeah.
Okay? That's what he gets from me.
I think
that's a net. Why? You're such a bonehead.
Well, and what I like is that it is, you ban it, and consumption goes up. Okay, so everybody, listen. Everybody out there, pay attention. Okay, you want to ban it, you increase the allure of it, and people who've never tried it are going to try it. And when most people look at the issue, if they look at the issue, and you make them look at the issue, they're going to say, "You crazy vegetarian people are telling me what to eat too much."
Well, it's, you know, we've discussed this ad nauseum. We don't need to talk about it anymore. It's not cruel to the ducks. It is a food and a reasonably gotten food.
As a matter of fact, you know what? I brought a little right here. Let's have a quick snack. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Justin Hartung. He is the restaurants editor for New York for CitySearch.com. He's responsible for covering the entire New York dining scene, including new restaurants and uncovering seasonal culinary trends. Hartung is also freelance for New York Magazine's website, and his works appeared in The Village Voice, New York Newsday, The New York Press, etc., etc.
Justin, welcome to the show today.
Hi, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
I have to tell you, Justin, we use City Search all the time.
Good to hear.
It's just to find an address, to look up a restaurant, to find something in a specific neighborhood. I think it's really terrific.
It's become one of those things that we check every single time that we go out to a new restaurant.
That's all good to hear.
Well, the other thing is I use it when I go to other cities.
Right.
You know, I think it's great. Now, why don't you explain to people City Search is a it's a hybrid. I mean, you're an actual you're a restaurant. You review restaurants. There are editorial reviews on City Search, but there are also user reviews on City Search. How do those two things work together?
Okay, we basically have, I mean, we have one of the largest databases, if not the largest database in the country, of restaurant coverage with actual editorial reviews. And I cover the New York scene with the help of freelancers and also other people on staff here in the New York office. But cities across the country also have editors. So we go out, we find the new sort of hottest spots, we write reviews, we rate them. We sort of, the reviews are sort of also geared to help sort of users that are going to those restaurants make decisions about what kind of dishes to order, what they can expect as far as the scene, the look of the place, even things about what to drink, special things that might be on the menu. And so we sort of guide users as the top authoritative voice, but then users, as you mentioned, they also chime in and say, hey, that drink you mentioned really stunk. We like this one better. Or, you know, wow, we totally disagree with you about the look of the place. We liked it. So it's always an interesting kind of balance. You sort of interact with them and sort of hear what they have to say, and then you think about it the next time you go to the next restaurant. And our jobs are sort of, you know, we can't really sort of say, hey, we don't like this kind of restaurant. Our job is to cover all the restaurants and sort of keep an open mind and really look at why a certain user would want to go to that kind of restaurant. Because if a restaurant's popular, we're going to cover it. And if it's not, we're probably going to sort of, you know, not go too deeply into it.
Gloss over it, sure.
Well, right. Now, do you ever find instances where the editorial review is at odds pretty completely with the user reviews, the reader reviews?
Sure. I mean, it happens all the time. If you look at sort of any given review, you're going to get a real wild sort of variation on sort of how people react to a restaurant. People can go and just, you know, something will set them off. It can be something as minor as, you know, their fork had a tong out of place on it.
Or yes, we know.
Yeah, exactly. You guys do this for a living, so you know about all of this. Or there are people who have really valid concerns, like, wow, this dish was so salty, I could barely eat it. And then you get people who praise everything and are just excited to be on the web and sort of post these ecstatic, cheerling reviews about everything. And I think, hopefully at this point, sort of readers and users know how to sort of parse out that information and figure out, you know, what are the wild kind of extremes on either end and really look to that center and sort of get the information that they want.
I think that you've hit it right on point there. Generally, when I look at the reader reviews and these types of things, and unlike when I look at professional reviews, when I look at reader reviews, I kind of tend to filter out the ones that are totally positive and only say great things, and I kind of filter out the ones that are totally negative and only say negative
things. Well, because you can click on the user and go and look at his or her reviews of other places and see what kind of reviewer that person mm-hmm. is.
Absolutely, and that's something that we sort of encourage sort of our users to do, and it's a way that we use their information that they provide us, is if they've been out in the city and are really covering a ton of restaurants for us and writing lots of user reviews, then they're probably to be more trusted. Mm. We often get people who just sort of come on once and sort of have this reactionary
right,
post.
To rant.
Right.
I have to say, I was at a very swank cocktail lounge, which will remain nameless, in Manhattan, and the owner's a friend, and she happened to be behind the bar that night, and there was some folks that came in, and some celebrity was sitting over in the corner, and there was this party of just obnoxious people, like 15 of them. And they came in, and they were trouble. They were really trouble. And they wanted to approach the celebrity and ask for, you know, talk to her, and then it got bad, as that kind of scene you might imagine gets bad. And finally, the proprietress said, "Listen, you guys, your check is comped. It's on me. Just leave.
Time to go."
And they were a little drunk. I honestly think they were doing a little coke, and it was time for them to leave. It was the right decision to make. And it's funny, when they left, she said, "And you can read about that on City Search tomorrow."
Really? Oh, wow. Well, that's the kind of thing we're pretty watchful for.
Well, but that's what I was going to ask you about. I mean, it doesn't strike me when I use City Search it strikes me that it is very accurate. How do you police that someone's not out to rig the results one way or the other?
Are you guys filtering in any way?
We don't at all. Initially, people post things. I mean, it doesn't go up immediately. I forget what the time lag is, but it's nothing sort of too long. So things go up pretty raw, and we just sort of keep an eye for things that are really sort of, you know, over the top slanderous or could be sort of interpreted as slanderous. If it's things like, you know, accusing the staff, there was one instance where somebody accused the staff of being on coke, and it was, you know, that's something that we can't really.
Yeah, that's not really cool.
Yeah, so you better substantiate that.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So we're careful about stuff like that, but we don't really sort of look at every review to make sure it goes up. We have a profanity filter, obviously, built in.
But if they had linked to YouTube where there was a video of the staff doing coke, would you have let it go? That's a rhetorical question. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking to Justin Hartung from CitySearch.com. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Our guest today is Justin Hartung. He's the restaurants editor for CitySearch.com, New York.
So, Justin, Francis and I have a tiny little bone to pick with you guys. You know,
sure.
you guys cover places like New York City very, very well, and sometimes the provinces outside don't get quite as much foot traffic, we'll say, from CitySearch as some of the other places. But you may not know this, but back in 2000, Stage Left won CitySearch's award for best burger in New York City, and we only offer that burger at the bar. But we won best burger in New York City, and the very next year you banned us because you said we were too far out of New York City.
Yeah, we got disqualified, man.
So
here's your penance, Justin. You have to come to Jersey and eat a burger. You know, you don't have to write about us, but one day we're going to kidnap you and bring you to Jersey and eat a burger.
I'm certainly open to a good burger always. So now
is CitySearch, I mean, is the name indicative of, do you focus on the major cities, and does CitySearch have plans to go out into the outlying areas, like, you know, the best hamburger in Dubuque, Idaho?
You know, we're always looking to expand our coverage. Sort of currently, we just have the major markets covered, and that for the New York side is really focusing on mostly just basically Manhattan, but also a little Brooklyn and Queens. Can't say we get out to Staten Island as much as we'd like to, or Jersey, or the Bronx.
How much would you like to get out to Staten Island?
Always more. You know, it's I love food, and so I love exploring things that are off the map a bit. And obviously, it's on your map. It's just for the New York sort of users.
Right, sure.
Not a priority. But, you know, we're always looking to expand coverage, and yeah, I'd love to get out there and try the burger.
I mean, we were just busting your chops, really. But is CitySearch always, because frankly, I live in Jersey City, so I'm in Manhattan all the time, and you do pretty fair coverage for North Jersey. But is CitySearch's eventual goal to be sort of a nationwide, or is it to be focused on the cities and the major metropolitan areas? Is the scope smaller?
Well, we have an interesting sort of mix of what we're doing, which is half directory. We get a lot of just sort of almost yellow page information fed into us from various databases around the country. And so we really do hope to cover as much of the country as possible. And obviously, where we can get editorial coverage on that, we want that and we'll strive for that. But, you know, it's always just a sort of a matter of resources and sort of focus on what's working best.
What is it they say? It's a small world, but I wouldn't want to have to paint it. Is that the philosophy? We're talking with Justin Hartung from CitySearch.com. After the news, we'll be talking more with him just about how they go about generating those editorial reviews that you can find. Of course, you can find CitySearch.com directly or link to them through our website, RestaurantGuysRadio.com. More after the news. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott, Together, we own Stage Left and Capital Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
We're talking today with Justin Hartung. He is the restaurants editor for City Search New York. And now, Justin, you have written for print in the past as well, and now you're the editor for restaurants and all things culinary for New York City Search, which is a pretty important position. Do you think, as a writer, do you find differences for when you write for an online publication as for when you write for a print publication?
Certainly. I mean, just as far as the prose style goes, you're obviously sort of talking to a different audience. It's probably a little bit younger. A little more sort of reliant on kind of pop cultural language, a little more pithy. It's sort of an advantage of being able to write online is you're allowed a little more freedom in a lot of ways about sort of how to talk to your audience. I think it's a more kind of democratic process where you sort of talk to them as if they are your peers instead of you're talking to them, you know, sort of from this New York Times view sort of looking down. I mean, not that they do that, but, you know, it's a different approach. So I enjoy the sort of freedom of writing for the web. It's an interesting format because things go up and they stay up, and there's a real sort of the archive. So you have this voice that you develop, especially things like blog culture. You're sort of getting this sort of constantly evolving archive of a voice.
You know, it's interesting that you just mentioned that because, you know, we've been up on the web now for 2 years, and we have a wonderful group of listeners here in the local area, but we actually have more listeners across the country through the web now. We're one of the top, if not the top, I don't know if it's the top, but one of the top food podcasts. But people listen, and we get emails from France, from Japan, with a guy in Tokyo keeps writing us. But one of the things that's very interesting now that we've been doing this for a couple of years is we have about 300 shows. And so when someone finds us, they go back and they'll go through the shows that we haven't thought about in 2 years, and I think that we do get
a lot of questions on shows we did a year and a half ago.
And I think that what's interesting is it's the same thing when you guys write for City Search. It's not like it's in the New York Times this week and then it's passed and it still lives pasted on the wall and on the website of that restaurant. It still lives.
Right. And sometimes you have to be accountable for it.
Yeah, that's true. Do you find that the expectations are for you to get things up faster because you're on the web, to kind of review places quicker, to be that kind of first in organization?
Well, the way I think about it is we're somewhere between the blogs and the New York Times. I mean, we sort of don't want to jump on places just to break a story because we're really looking for places that have proven themselves as being sort of buzzworthy places and places we want to send our users. So we don't necessarily kind of just jump on the immediate opening, and we also want to give restaurants time to sort of get their system working, get their kitchens going, and make sure they've sort of settled and what the users are going to experience is sort of what we write about. But we also do have the advantage of being able to just sort of go write the review and put it up. And so we're sort of somewhere in between, I'd say, traditional print media and, say, a blog.
You know, as a restaurant owner, and you hit on this pretty clearly, I don't want a reviewer in my restaurant in the first month, 2 months, even 3 months.
Right.
You know, I want the reviewers to come after because things are going to happen, you know, in that early period that you know, are unexpected. You're opening a new space, a new restaurant that hopefully is a unique concept.
Well,
That's going to have unique problems.
But let's talk about how this relates to, and I think this is very interesting. I mean, when I was, you know, 20, it was the cool kids found out about a place and went there for a while. And then sort of the semi-cool kids for, like, you know, a month and a half. And then the semi-cool kids sort of filtered in. And then, you know, Egg Magazine wrote about it. Or you know, maybe by the time it appeared in the Village Voice of the New Yorker, you know, we used to call them the suits. The suits were would be there, and then the club kids had to find someplace else to go.
Now you wear a suit.
And now I'm a suit. I can't believe it. Another story, but yeah, I'm a suit now. But with the advent of sites like City Search, the lead time for when a place opens, and let's talk bars, not restaurants. So we're talking more about buzz than, you know, give them time to get the chef down and the service down and all that. Things are on the web almost immediately after opening. And you're seeing sort of a counterculture of places like Milk and Honey and a number of other places, like was written about in the New York Times just last week, where they don't want their address published. They don't want to be crazy busy.
Right, they want the neighborhood people, and they don't want you to publicize it.
How do you? Because I know you guys list Milk and Honey, and you I'm sure at their request don't list a phone number or an address for them. How does City Search play in the way that the cultural nightlife has changed in New York and speaks to issues of you know, when a place becomes hot and when a place wants to sort of stay off the radar?
Well, I can even tie that in specifically to the restaurant section with, obviously, the Waverly Inn, which is a very hot restaurant right now that's, you know, not there isn't a number published, and the only way to get in is to show up and call Graydon Carter. And, you know, I'm sort of trying to figure out myself how and when to cover that. And it's you really do want to respect the restaurant's right to do that. But at the same time, the soft opening phenomenon of things just sort of being pushed back and back and back, and it builds buzz, and I understand why they do it, but it sort of makes it hard to know when to sort of move in.
Well, let me explain for our listeners, because, you know, not everybody out there is in the business what a soft opening is about. When a restaurant, a hard opening is, you know, on your first day of business, you bring the truck outside with the spotlights, and you hang a banner that says grand opening, and you serve champagne. That's a hard opening. A soft opening is when, you know, after your night of friends and family where you're not really open and you just bring in people to practice, you just sort of don't tell anybody. We did a soft opening for Catherine Lombardi just because we wanted time to get our act together. We didn't tell any of the press we were open. We didn't put it on our website that we were open. We just sort of quietly opened the doors and wanted to do, you know, a limited amount of business for 2 or 3 weeks or 4 weeks till we got things down. Well, people have used this as a way to build buzz. It's called a soft opening. They open the doors, but you really can't get in, and maybe they'll let you in. And, you know, if you know the owner, you can get a table. And people are using this more and more to push, to run these. How long has that place been in soft opening now? What?
At least a month.
A month?
I think a little longer.
So that's an interesting thing about how people can use that. Is it a private club? What's the status of a restaurant that does a soft opening for 6 months? How long can they push it?
I think City Search also is not necessarily going to be the place you go to look for those kinds of spots at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're sort of in it for the long haul and really are trying to – I mean, obviously, we want to stay on top of things that are hot and new and popular. But again, it goes back to the user. And if the user is going to have trouble getting into this place for a reason as severe as we don't have a phone number or we don't take reservations, then that's not really where our focus is going to be.
Right. You don't want to point them to a place that they can't go to.
Exactly.
So
it's always about making useful decisions.
So what are the culinary trends you're seeing now or the trends in the dining scene you're seeing now besides, you know, big box restaurants opening up in the meatpacking district? What are we seeing on the radar for the future?
I think one of the most exciting things for me is sort of the counterpoint to that, which is the return. We're calling it around here the return of the boite. It's really nice to have these small, homey neighborhood restaurants where the focus, again, is on the food and the fresh ingredients and just a really comfortable, small space. It's not overwhelming. I'm really enjoying that. There obviously were a few really big openings in the last year, Little Owl, Cafe Clooney, Porchetta, that have gotten all this attention from sort of the big restaurant world, but they're really essentially small neighborhood places. And to me, that's exciting. People talk about sort of New Yorkers going out to eat because restaurants are an extension of their living room, and I think that applies more here than almost anywhere else. And those kind of places, these new small neighborhood spots, are really appealing to that, and it's nice.
I think it's a reaction to the – I mean, I frankly don't care for personally, and again, you know, we're, believe it or not, broadcast journalists. I can't believe it. But, you know, and we're food professionals, and we need to know what's going on in the world. And so we've gone to a number of those big box places downtown. And I tell you, why does anybody want to eat in 30,000 square feet of a restaurant where you're one of 900 diners? I don't understand it. And I think the boite, or the return of the little neighborhood place that's really cool, is sort of a reaction to that. I mean, do you think that the big box restaurant, you know, is under any sort of a threat? How long do you think that's going to last?
I don't think that's going to go away anytime soon. I mean, a funny sort of counter-argument is that Budokan had this phenomenal year, and people really do like the food, and it's really popular, and it doesn't seem to be in any danger of losing kind of buzz at any time soon. So, I mean, as long as the focus is on the food and it's sort of done well, then I think that'll probably survive, and it'll certainly thrive in neighborhoods like the Meatpacking District, which have such a huge sort of, you know, they have these huge factories and
huge spaces.
Huge spaces. So, they can really accommodate that kind of thing. I think it's when they try and force it into neighborhoods where that doesn't necessarily feel organic, then that's when it's going to run into trouble.
Will they remain cool, or will they just be full of people, eventually just be full of people from New Jersey and the outer boroughs?
That's hard to say, you know, but I think that basically they will remain cool sort of for a certain crowd. Put it that way.
Let me tell you something. It better be for a while because they're worth like $100 million to build one of those places. We'll be back in just a moment talking more with Justin Harding of CitySearch.com. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:46.
Floors, walls, and lighting. The Restaurant Guys learned long ago that the key to making a space look great are floors, walls, and lighting. There's no tougher test to a carpet than a busy restaurant. From design to installation to cleaning, the Gillespie Group has handled the Restaurant Guys restaurant floors for more than 10 years. Designers know what looks great on the first day. Bob Gillespie knows what will continue to look great year after year. Gillespie doesn't just install carpets. Their quality clean division has experience and expertise to keep that carpet looking great. In our business, it's the details that matter. In your home or office, the details make a lasting impression. The Gillespie Group handles projects from large hotels to offices right down to your living room. Look down. Go on, look down. Right there by your feet. You see, you need the Gillespie Group. Call them at 732-254-5508 or visit them at thegillespiegroup.com. Tell them the Restaurant Guys sent you and get a free cleaning with any installation. Remember, it's Gillespie for carpet and flooring, 732-254-5508.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left in Capital Party Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Justin Hartung. He's the restaurants editor for CitySearch.com for New York. And we were talking before the break about rating individual restaurants and coming up with trends, but you guys also publish lists of different sorts, like the best burger, best Italian, best whatever, but top 10 restaurants for one reason or another, top 10 bars in the country. How do you come up with the criteria, and what are the kind of roundups you're doing?
Well, we sort of have three tiers of roundups. We do these editorial roundups, which are sort of chosen seasonally, basically things that are going on in the city. We have right now, for instance, on the restaurant page, a Restaurant Week planner, and for your listeners who don't know, Restaurant Week is something they do a couple times a year where a lot of the big restaurants, Spice Market, Megu, Telepan, there's a ton of them, offer these great lunch and dinner specials. I think it's like $35 to go eat there. And we do sort of a feature on that. We're sort of currently running a feature on offbeat finds, which is restaurants that are, you know, sort of unusual or off the beaten path. There's a great place in Williamsburg called Zenkichi, which is this new, really fun, small place Japanese restaurant that's very kind of mysterious and almost sort of film noirish. And they have these blinds that you can pull down on your serious private great dining experience. And the food is actually surprisingly terrific. I mean, it sort of transcends any sort of gimmick. And so we do things like that. We have a great fireplace roundup that we're running right now, because it's actually finally winter here.
Finally cold, yes.
Yep. And we do deals. It's a lot of sort of great lists, and it's a good way for us to feature sort of older restaurants that we want to kind of pull back into the spotlight. So it's a lot of fun. We also do insider lists, which our users create, and that allows them a way to sort of say, hey, here's my list of top 10 kind of places to go with fireplaces. So users can build their own lists, and eventually, hopefully, they'll be able to share those lists and talk about them.
Do you know what's funny? I use your I just occurred to me when I have been going to City Search a lot is I find myself I'm often off on a Sunday night. You know, that's a night that a restaurateur is often likely to have an evening off. And you know, if I'm looking for Irish music at a bar in New York, I go to your site and I type in, you know, Irish music bar, you know, Manhattan, and
I do the same thing, and then I avoid those places.
And I think the searchable feature of your database is really tremendous. But these top 10, these top 10 lists or these roundup lists, I think, you know, I sort of stick them in my folder for you know when it's time to go find a place with a fireplace. You came up in December of 2006. There was the top 10 new bars in the country. Now, how in the world do you take all the bars in the country, or all the new bars in the country, and come up with 10 that are that remarkable. What makes them that remarkable? Is it that the local readers like them so much, or is that purely editorial? How does that happen?
It's a combination of, I mean, if I think I know the one you're talking about, it's most of the major cities did their own top 10 lists for restaurants and for bars, and then we all sort of get on the phone and talk about sort of our candidates for, you know, we think this one also belongs on the top 10 of the list for the country. And that's based on sort of our own editorial judgment, but also you're right about what users are saying and what the buzz is. And sort of, you know, L.A. will say, hey, we know about the Waverly Inn and the West Village because we've been hearing about it. So there is a lot of kind of crosstalk across the country.
All right. Well, we're going to ask you, we're getting toward the end of the segment, but I want to ask you, give me the name of a bar and give me the name of a restaurant that our listeners may not have heard of that it's worth, if they're going to be in Manhattan, if they're going to be in New York City, making a trek to. Give me a bar.
Sure. Death & Co. is the new sort of hot bar that's just opened up, which is really focusing on amazing cocktails and sort of putting the artistry back in cocktails. And a great restaurant. I am really a big fan right now of Kampuchea, which is a sort of Cambodian noodle bar in the East Village, sort of Lower East Side. And it's, I don't know if you know Momofuku Noodle Bar.
Yeah, of course.
They're kind of trying to do the same thing, but with kind of a Cambodian twist. And I thought it worked really well. And it's a really nice room and pleasant space.
Well,
those are cool places. We're waiting for you to do the best restaurant radio show list, 10 best, and we're waiting for that to come out.
Certainly top 10.
So. That's our. Actually, we were in the top 10 in what magazine was that? Was that Time Out New York put us in the top 4.
Great.
The best. Anyway, but we want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be on the show with us and talk about your website. I think it's tremendous, and I think our listeners
I think it's a real asset for people going out to restaurants and checking out things, especially if it's a city they're unfamiliar with.
Right. Thanks, and thanks for having me on.
That's great, Justin. Thanks a lot. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. We were talking with Justin Harding from CitySearch.com. You know, Mark, I will tell you, I talked a little bit about it with Justin in the meat of the interview. We were talking about, you know, how it used to be there was the cool place, and because we used to go out all the time, and we would find out what the cool place was, and our friends were cool, so we knew what the cool place was. And then, like, the less cool kids, to be honest, we were probably in the second tier of cool, right? But then the third tier of cool would come in behind us, and then it was...
And then it was a free-for-all.
And then it was in New York Magazine, and it was a free-for-all, right? I just, you know, I think that people... who maybe don't go out anymore don't realize, well, they must, but people who are older may not realize what it's like to go out and meet people today, and people who are younger don't realize what it used to be like when you didn't have a cell phone and email to tell you where to go. You heard about this place, and maybe you knew where the address was, and maybe you were going to be there or not, and you would call the other guy's answering machine. You'd be like, okay, we're going to be here at this time. We'll rendezvous at midnight at this place, and we're only going to be there for 15 minutes.
And sometimes you'd hook up, and sometimes you wouldn't.
And what was you'd miss people sometimes. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, groups of people would fracture, but that made it much more interesting. And I find that... it can be too insular when people are always on their cell phones and always in touch. Of course, I don't put mine down for a minute, and I have GPS on it. If I ever get lost, I just punch in the address and I go where I want to go. But it's a different culture today with the internet telling you where to go. And City Search, by the way, you can now get recommendations text messaged to your phone.
Right.
So if you want to find a pizzeria in the neighborhood,
right, you just type in the zip code and the you say pizza. And they'll text message you
the top four
pizzerias in the neighborhood.
Yeah, I don't know that I like that. But, you know, it's funny. I say I don't know that I like it, but I do it like I'm eating chocolates. I can't stop. You know, it's a very different ethos. But I think one of the things we need to remember is to put the cell phones away sometimes and to let things go by word of mouth sometimes and just
talk to you know what? Just talk to the person who's sitting in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
Forget about the person who's not who you're gonna meet later or who's buzzing your cell phone. Talk to the person sitting in front of you.
Oh wait, Mark, my cell phone's ringing. I gotta take it. Hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott
and I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.